ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, I'm Fran Kelly, and this is the Radio National Hour, coming to you from the land of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation in Sydney. Coming up, the debate over immigration is heating up, tougher values tests, a ban on migrants from certain countries, political leaders on the right are in a race to slam the door shut hard and fast. Also ahead, change or die. That was Angus Taylor's frank assessment of the future for the Liberal Party after he wrenched the leadership from Susan Lee on Friday. Tonight on Four Corners, Patricia Karvelas looks at how surging populism is causing division and fury within the Liberal Party and rewriting the Conservative script in Australia. And she's more New York than a yellow cab and even spikier than Lady Liberty. Just don't ask Fran Lebowitz what she really thinks about Donald Trump.
The real estate developers look down on him. I mean, can you imagine a level of moral squalor so profound that real estate developers look down on you?
The New York flaneur, or should I say franeur, Fran Lebowitz, joins me later this hour. The Liberal Party might have a new leader, but Angus Taylor seems set on reigniting a very old policy debate. Is Australia letting too many of the wrong people into our country?
Our borders have been open to people who hate our way of life. People who don't want to change for Australia, but who want Australia to change for them. Crime is widespread and we've had the worst terrorist attack on our soil in our history, perpetrated by an Islamist extremist.
It's a thesis that argues high migration is pushing up rents, straining infrastructure, and leaving young Australians locked out of housing, not to mention undermining the essential character of what it means to be Australian. But what would a lower, stricter migration intake mean in practice? Is it really possible? And how much of a difference would it make? Abul Rizvi is a former Deputy Secretary of the Department of Immigration. Anthea Hancox is the CEO of the Scanlon Research Institute, which has just released a paper today commissioned by the Department of Home Affairs titled Multiculturalism in Focus, Migrant Sense of Belonging. And Brendan Coates is the Housing and Economic Security Program Director at the Grattan Institute. Welcome, all of you. Thank you for joining me on the Radio National Hour.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Abul, new Liberal leader Angus Taylor has supercharged the debate over immigration since he's been elected, declaring, and I quote, "the door must be shut to people who do not align with Australian values." What are the Australian values that all visa applicants currently have to sign up to before they're allowed to come to Australia?
They relate essentially to things like support for the rule of law, support for democracy, a parliamentary democracy, support for freedom of religion, support for freedom and dignity of the individual. And interestingly, the fair go for all, including for migrants. So it has all of those factors into the document that migrants must sign before they can become permanent residents or enter as a temporary entrant.
And in signing that, is there any way to test it? I mean, I think that what Angus Taylor's talking about here is testing it.
It's not tested at the moment. All the applicant has to do is digitally sign the document. Yes, you could think about how you might test those things, like things such as that. It would be a pretty complicated test. It would have to be in a physical location to avoid the person using AI to answer the questions. It would probably have to be done in a range of languages because many of the people who migrate to Australia, particularly humanitarian entrants or family reunion entrants, or indeed the partners and dependent children of Skillstream entrants, may not have very good English. So running a test like this in English would make things very, very awkward. Finally, I think ultimately the number of people who that test would reject would probably be pretty small. The cost of implementing the test would be enormous. The length of delays that would create in an already massively clogged visa system would be enormous.
Anthea, you've just finished this major study looking at multiculturalism and migrants here and their sense of belonging to Australia. What does the data tell you about the values of migrants, the ones who are here, when it comes to things like belief in democracy, the rule of law, freedom of speech and religion? Are these concepts concepts that they generally have an understanding and appreciation of? Do new migrants feel like they've signed on to Australian values? Do you know?
Yes, certainly they do. And in actual fact, it really does demonstrate that that's the reason why they want to come here in the first place, is because they want those values. They want them as a part of their lives. And they tend to mix quite well once they get here. So they're associating with a broad range of people from different backgrounds. It's not like they just stay within one particular cultural group. And mostly that's because they like the freedom, they like that sense of respect, and they want a country that is safe and secure, hence the fact that they really do like the rule of law as being something that they can see is going to keep them safe.
Well, the Liberal Party was poised to release its immigration policy this week, but that was before Susan Lee was rolled. Obviously, we don't know how the policy will look under Angus Taylor, if it's going to change at all, but the leaked copy we've seen of the draft policy of Susan Lee's suggests making this value statement a condition of being able to stay in Australia. That is, if you breach our values, you could be expelled from the country. From a practical perspective, how would one enforce that?
I think the first issue with that is we have a Section 501 character test. It is extraordinarily broad. The character test goes to issues not just of criminality, but it goes to things like vilification of others in the community. Mm-hmm. It goes to things like sowing discord into the community. Those are all factors in which the minister could use to cancel someone's visa.
Troublemaking, basically.
Exactly. There is absolutely no doubt in my mind that if Mr. Herzog was not the president of Israel and had applied for a visa to Australia, he would have been refused on character grounds. No question at all. It's a straight up and down fact, that.
But what if you're in Australia and you have a visa? This notion, as I understand it, is that the Liberal Party has suggested they may be going here, that if someone breaches our values, they could be expelled, have their visa cancelled.
The question is, what would you do that is contrary to Australian values but not contrary to Section 501 of the character provisions?
Well, say you held up a sign that said, you know, globalise the intifada or something. Would that be in breach of our values?
Well, it could easily be found to be in breach of Section 501 of the character provisions as well, because it's sowing discord.
So when you read that, as someone who's worked in the department, what do you think? What comes to your mind?
What comes to my mind is potentially, if you're going to go down that path, you'll cover an enormous range of circumstances where people might be discussing, you know, democracy or something, and whether democracy is good or bad. Is that a breach of our values? It all gets into very, very murky territory.
You're listening to the Radio National Hour. My guests are Anthea Hancocks from the Scanlon Research Institute and Abul Rizvi, the former Deputy Secretary of the Department of Immigration, and Brendan Coates, the Program Director of the Grattan Institute. Brendan, let's come to you now because Angus Taylor has also said that when it comes to migrants, quote, the numbers are too high. And there is often a link made in terms of the surge in immigration post-COVID till now with housing pressures, infrastructure pressures. Before we talk about that link, though, can I ask you about the economic role that migrants play in Australia at the moment? How do you quantify, or can we quantify, the economic impact of migrants right now?
Sure. So, Fran, there's a couple of different ways you can think about this. The first of which is that migration obviously slows the ageing of the Australian population. So that has an effect in the long term of helping keep the budget more sustainable, making sure we've got the workforce that we need as our population ages so that we've got people to, say, look after grandparents in nursing homes and the like. There's also a direct fiscal or budgetary benefit, which is that migrants, particularly permanent migrants, skilled visa holders, which is the bulk of the program, they pay far more in tax than they draw in services over their lifetimes in Australia. For the typical skilled visa holder, we're talking about $250,000. So that's like that migrant, when they're granted their permanent visa, the right to stay permanently, handing over a check to federal and state governments of $250,000. So that's an enormous benefit that Australia gets from being a very attractive place for younger skilled people to want to come to and make a life in Australia. And then there's potentially also innovation and productivity spillovers, that people who come from abroad bring ideas, have worked abroad with their skills, and bring new business practices and approaches to Australia, which can hopefully lift our flagging rate of productivity growth here in Australia.
And Andrew, does that track with your research? How are migrants generally viewed by the Australian public in terms of the contribution they make to not just our society, but our economy?
Well, apart from First Nations people, absolutely all of us are migrants. So in many respects, we are all, recognise the contribution that we all make to the Australian economy. So it's an incredibly important part. I think if you're talking about recent migrants, they want to be able to grow their families. They want to be able to grow the assets that they've got to pass on to others. So all of those things that all of us value, they also value.
And your report today showed that for nearly half the people you interviewed, the migrants you interviewed, finding meaningful employment is their biggest challenge. Does that suggest we aren't selecting the right people to come to Australia, or we aren't supporting them in the right way when they get here? What's the picture you saw?
I know, getting a job from a standing start is very difficult for just about anybody. And in actual fact, there are some things that are inherent in the way that we view people applying for employment. So one of those is the recognition of international experience versus local experience. So sometimes that can be a hurdle. Sometimes it's simply that individuals, their English isn't particularly good, and so they need a little bit more time in order to become more skilled at speaking English that is actually going to carry them through a job. And other times they just need a network or an introduction in order to get there. So there are a number of different hurdles that actually apply to people regardless of whether they're migrants or not.
So, Brendan, I guess we all know that. We've all met people driving an Uber who have, you know, significant skills and education from another country and can't get work. But is that something, you mentioned productivity, could that be one of the answers to improving our productivity, which is, you know, better matching the skills we have in the country, even if we've imported them, to the jobs that need to be done or the skill gaps?
Yeah, Fran, I think it's probably worth just emphasising that even the typical migrant in a given occupation or given level of skills will probably earn less than the typical incumbent Australian with that same set of qualifications. That doesn't mean that migrants are on average not skilled. They're actually more skilled on average than the Australian community as a whole, particularly those that are coming through our permanent migration program who are granted that right to stay in Australia and work for decades. There are challenges, as Anthea pointed to, but it also does mean probably being clear that we should be clear and try to be as successful as possible in selecting those migrants that are likely to succeed in Australia long-term through those skilled migration programs.
And are we good at that? I mean, are we getting the skills we need?
We're pretty good. We probably could be better. And that's why, Martin Parkinson, the former Secretary of the Treasury and PM&C, did a report, a review into the migration program that recommended changes to the points test, mm-hmm. or looking at that. That has not yet been enacted by government, and we're waiting. I think many of us are waiting to see what the government will do there. So we could be better at basically who we choose, mm-hmm. To come to Australia, basically because once you've made that choice to grant permanent residency to someone, they're going to be in the workforce for 3 to 4 decades. It has an enormous mix on the composition of skills we have in the Australian economy in the long term. So getting that right is a win-win for both the migrant and for the Australian community.
I'm going to come to you, Abel, in a moment with the number of visas, because that's a point of difference too. But to quote the former Treasury Secretary, Martin Parkinson, again, who's done that review for Labor in 2023, he said that reducing migration could have a pretty negative impact on economic growth. How significant could that be if we're talking a reduction in the order of what we're discussing at the moment? I think current levels are over 300 and Labor's looking at 225,000 and the Coalition are talking apparently 170,000.
It will slow the rate of economic growth marginally if you were to reduce that rate of net overseas migration down to, say, 170,000. Mm-hmm. I think the bigger question is, what does that mean for the permanent program and the number of skilled visa holders that you're selecting each year? Because it's really hard to imagine reducing the numbers to that level without pretty significantly reducing the size of that skilled migrant intake.
Why? Given,
well, because when we think about the composition of the intake, there's parts of the intake that are related to family, so particularly partners. So Australians have the right, if they meet someone abroad, to have that person come to Australia and join them permanently, which means that if you're trying to squeeze the intake, you're probably going to have to squeeze a lot of the skilled intake. That is a large number of the visas that we offer each year in Australia today. And if you were to cut that program, as we mentioned before, $250,000 is the fiscal payoff, the benefit we get from each skilled visa holder over their lifetime. So if you were to shrink the program, you could easily imagine tens of billions of dollars in lost taxes, net of the services they draw, which means Australians are having to pay higher levels of taxes for the services they enjoy, or enjoying poorer quality health and other services than what they get currently.
So, Abel, if I can get you to expand on what Brendan's been talking about there, as I say, we don't have a specific number from Angus Taylor yet in terms of their new immigration policy, but the word is, the leak suggests it was going to be around 170,000, which is still well below the 225,000 forecast by the Treasury in Labor's budget for this year and the year after. If the coalition was to adopt that kind of figure, what would they have to do to reduce net migration to that number? I mean, Brendan's there suggesting they'd have to cut skilled migration. I mean, can you make a cut of that size quickly? And what's the impact of it?
Making that size cut quickly would be difficult. It is possible to reduce net migration without reducing the permanent program. Canada's actually just done that. They've only marginally reduced the permanent program. They predominantly cut students and temporary workers, and they brought net migration down quite a bit. But they were assisted by a very, very high unemployment rate. In Australia, we still have a relatively strong labour market. So if the coalition wanted to bring down net migration in the way the Canadians have, they would need both a weak labour market as well as dramatic cuts to both students and temporary workers, working holiday makers, etc.
You're listening to the Radio National Hour. My guests are Abul Rizvi, a former Deputy Secretary of the Department of Immigration, Anthea Hancocks from the Scanlon Research Institute, and Brendan Coates from the Grattan Institute. One of the arguments against migration, which has been about for quite a while now, and which Angus Taylor and others talk about, is the impact it has on cost of living and particularly things like house prices and infrastructure costs. You've looked specifically at this, Brendan. If Australia was to reduce its migration level substantially, what would be the impact on rents and house prices in particular?
That's a great question, Frank. It really depends how long you keep in or sustain those lower levels of migration, because ultimately house prices and rents are determined by the balance in the of demand and supply in the stock of housing. And so if you cut the migration program for, say, 1 year and then return it to where the previous levels, then it won't have a bigger impact. But if you keep those cuts in place for, say, a decade, it has a much larger impact. So, mm-hmm. for example, if we were to shave 100,000 per year off the net overseas migration number, so you know that would be taking it from, in the long term, from say 225,000 down to something more like 125,000, then over the course of a decade, you'd expect that rents and house prices might be something like 8 or 9% lower than they are currently. So it would have an effect because migrants, like everyone else, need somewhere to live. It just has those other effects we talked about before, potentially, that affect either the rate of economic growth or the long-term budget position of the government.
And not to mention getting the tradies in to build them, which is another one of the things that's adding to costs and time delays at the moment. Abul, there are some leaks today on the ABC and in Sky News that suggest one policy being considered by the coalition under Susan Lee's planned immigration policy, and we haven't seen Angus Taylor's yet, but it was to ban migration from certain countries, apparently around 13 countries on the list, including Palestine or Gaza, the Philippines, Lebanon, Afghanistan and Nigeria, which would mirror to some degree the approach taken up by the Trump administration, or perhaps more closely by the UK. What impact would that have if Australia went down that path?
So to implement a policy such as that, you would have to make two fairly significant legislative changes. Firstly, within the migration program to enable you to cap visas according to nationality. We don't have that power in the Migration Act. Secondly, you'd have to make amendments to the Race Discrimination Act. Whether you could get that through the Senate or not, I don't know. The next problem would be, essentially, that would mean an end to our humanitarian program. It would probably mean withdrawing from the Refugee Convention. The Trump administration has not withdrawn from the Refugee Convention, although I note One Nation is proposing to withdraw from the Refugee Convention. The next thing it would do is, I think, have a significant impact in terms of social cohesion. I think it would make migrants in Australia, not just the migrants of the countries that were banned, but probably migrants more generally, feel like second-class citizens. I think the longer-term, wider societal implications would be enormous from banning particular countries for migration to Australia.
Anthea, what do you think about that? Because your report looks at the migrant experience of people here from a number of countries, including a couple of the countries on this list, Iraq and yep. the Philippines for two. In your experience, how might this be received and what impact do you think it might have on a migrant's sense of belonging and social cohesion, as Abul put it there?
Well, I think it would be problematic. In actual fact, I think matching the numbers conversation with culture or ethnicity is a problem in itself. But that said,
in what sense?
In that I think there's a conversation to be had around numbers, and that's fine, it should be, but it shouldn't necessarily be tied to culture and ethnicity in the same way. The vast majority of Australians actually want a non-discriminatory approach to who comes here. They really are not expecting anybody to be discriminated against based on their country of origin. Australia has been at the forefront at migrant integration for quite some time. I think we've probably taken, sort of rested on our laurels a little for the last few years. But in actual fact, we have an opportunity to build on some enormous strengths that exist in Australia around that openness and that that sense of how important we think multiculturalism is to the look of Australia, to who we are as people.
Anthea Hancox, Abel Rivesvi and Brendan Coates, thank you very much for joining me here on the Radio National Hour.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Fran.
That's Abel Rivesvi is a former Deputy Secretary of the Department of Immigration. Anthea Hancox is the CEO of the Scanlon Research Foundation, which has released this major study today. And Brendan Coates is the Housing and Economic Security Program Director at the Grattan Institute. You're listening to the Radio National Hour.
On Breakfast Tomorrow with Sally Sara.
It's been more than a fortnight since the kidnapping of the mother of US Today show co-host Savannah Guthrie. You'll hear from a former FBI special agent. And on Changing Australia, you'll meet one of Australia's top engineers and the creator of UNESCO's World Engineering Day, Marlene Kanga.
ABC Radio National Breakfast. Weekday mornings from 6 or anytime on ABC Listen.
Australia's political right is in upheaval. The Liberal Party has a new leader, sure, but the battle ain't over. As One Nation surges in the polls, the Liberal Party is split between its centre-right tradition, the party we might recognise from the Howard Costello era, and a rising populist push. So what's the path to re-election for the coalition, and how do they calm the tensions within? This week, Four Corners takes you inside the struggle, shaping the future of Conservative politics and the nation. Patricia Karvelas has been on the front line of the fight. Well, she's been asking all the questions anyway. PK, welcome to the Radio National Hour.
Fran, you know I like to hang out with you.
I don't think I've ever said that before.
You have not invited me onto this program.
Imagine
so I was
that.
Very excited. I had to make a whole documentary to get invited.
Exactly. Well, I'm glad you have. Let's go to the title of your Four Corners tonight. It's called Realignment. Are you looking at the splintering within the Liberal Party and the coalition or within the broader electorate? What's the realignment you're examining here?
Okay, so the premise was, and we started this story way before, not way, but just before Bondi, which really changed things a lot, I think,
yep.
And before all of the sort of hate law discussion and all of the things we've seen, including the change in leadership on Friday. But the reason we started it is One Nation was already on the rise. Then they recruited Barnaby Joyce. Then the polling kept coming out, consistent, not one poll, poll after poll after poll, showing they were taking votes off the coalition in big numbers. So the story is about that realignment of voters wanting more of what One Nation is offering because they like this populism that they're seeing from Farage overseas. Remember, we live in a globalised world. Australians see what's happening around the world too. So we're not disconnected, in my view, see what's happening with Trumpism. They're moving to Pauline Hanson. And there's a struggle going on inside the Liberal Party about how to get those voters back. Not just win general elections, how to get their base back.
But let's talk about their base, because I was interested in, you spoke to Liberal moderate Tim Wilson, who by all accounts is going to be a major player, you know, he's likely to be the shadow treasurer in this Liberal Party, in this coalition. And in a sense, he suggests the base is the least of their problems.
You're one of the only urban Liberals left. That's it. There's not many.
Mm-hmm.
Is the direction the party is moving in palatable for your kind of constituents? Can you win without more of that, those urban seats, and do you need to change direction?
We can't win Australia if we don't win urban Australia. It's not about my preference, it's about a simple reality, one of the most urbanised countries
on Earth. And how do we do that? I don't believe that's by narrowing our base.
So I don't believe that's by narrowing our base. Who's reading the electorate correctly, PK, the voter base that they need? Is there a demand for a more right-wing populist policy or party, or is this a misjudgment of how the electorate's going with women, Gen Z, millennials deserting the Liberal Party on the other end?
Well, I've got James Patterson, who is kingmaker, really, key right-wing figure that swung his support behind Angus Taylor, was instrumental in Angus Taylor winning on Friday. He was blunt with me over the weekend, Fran, because you know I worked very hard over the weekend to try and redo this story. Well, the story changed, yeah. Right? And he said to me, this is about locking down our base. That was his language. And I nearly fell over because I thought, you are so upfront about what you're doing here. He said, we have to lean into issues, the flag, nationalism, things that our base right-wing voters want to hear. We need to be more defined on those issues because they're leaving us. So he sees it as an immediate repair job. Angus Taylor's job, as I see it, as they see it, is fix the bleeding, stop the bleeding, get the Band-Aids on, right? The Tim Wilsons of the world and the Tony Barrys of the world think if you're chasing down that cul-de-sac, yes, you might stop the bleeding of the of that group of people. So they agree, perhaps that might happen. However, the consequences for all the other parts of Australia will be profound potentially. Now, I suppose they're in a dilemma because what do you do, right? Like if you're losing left, right and centre, you have to make a decision yeah. about where you go. They've decided to go right. However, the story tonight, which I think is so fascinating, and I'm a little obsessed, as you can see, is that it's not the Conservatives are all at one. They are not. And I could not believe that this fiction that the Conservatives are just this big force. No, they're not. There's the populist Conservatives, led by people like Andrew Hastie, and who we have on the record tonight, Garth Hamilton, who's member for Groom. I spent some time with him, with voters in that area. You'll see these voters express exactly this sentiment. They want a different party, a populist party, economic nationalism.
Let's go to that because it's not, as you say, it's not just those big culture factors like the flag and those hot buttons, nationalism, immigration. We'll come back to immigration. But Senator Matt Canavan, he's a Nat, and he's part of this loud and growing fraction of the right that really wants to break from the Howard Costello free market approach. Here he is.
Do I think that the Liberal National parties can win with an ideological pursuit of free trade and free markets? No, I do not. I do not at all. Because I'm not in politics to deliver free trade. The loss of energy competitiveness means that we have to reconsider how much manufacturing we want in this country and how we're going to keep it here, including by protecting some of it from outside competition.
Now, PK, call me crazy, but I thought I heard new Liberal leader Angus Taylor saying almost something the exact opposite of that this morning when he was talking in response to Labor's notions of some kind of tax on, you know, countries that aren't, you know, using clean energy, et cetera. And he said, we are the party of free trade. We need more free trade, not less. So the Nats, okay, they're always a bit protectionist, but there are some prominent Liberals, you're saying, very much in tune with this thinking. Angus Taylor's going to have his work cut out for him.
He is, because that divide is actually growing and it's profound. Now, people like Andrew Hastie have said we've got to get away from this Howard Costello era because it's no longer reality. Now, Andrew Hastie is actually correct, not on the solution, that's not up to me, but he's right that the era is different. Lots of things have happened. And some of these younger members in the Liberal Party, Garth Hamilton is another one, he speaks on it on the record. We need to change a lot. We need to embrace a different type of politics, and it's populism that they're talking about. Now, the old guard Liberals, who are still capital C conservatives, so they're still broadly in the same church, if you like Angus Taylor, they don't mind leaning in, we can get into it, on immigration. They understand or they think that that's important. However, on economic issues, they want to be more purists, you know, economic rationalists. And I think there's a real tension there. The reason I think it's a tension is it's really like an interesting policy space, but it's a proxy war for leadership. So if Angus Taylor is unsuccessful as leader, and what? How long did Susan Lee get? 9 months? So if he can't make inroads in 9 months, I'm sure everyone...
November?
People will be gunning for him, right? So then who are the contenders? someone like Andrew Hastie comes through and says, we need a different kind of thing, because he's been arguing it anyway, or depends who wins. There are lots of moderates still. Tim Wilson, you know, we need, these are different philosophies though, wildly different.
Wow, that's a real shift. I cannot wait to tune in tonight, PK. Talk about timing, perfect for the questions you're asking. Four Corners tonight, everyone, on ABC TV at 8:30 or, of course, anytime on iView. Thanks, PK.
Thanks, Fran.
PK, before you go, you'll never guess who I'm talking to next.
Someone fabulous, I'm guessing. Yeah. Almost as good as me.
Almost. Another great Fran, as it turns out, Fran Lebowitz.
I love Fran Lebowitz. She's like the queen of New York. My sister actually went and saw her in Melbourne when she's awesome and doesn't miss a great line about Donald Trump.
No, she doesn't. She's all over it in this interview too. She's coming out again. I mean, just imagine how a New Yorker right now like her is feeling with the Epstein files flying around. It's huge.
Relaxing. Yeah. Relaxing. Those files are very relaxing for the women of the world. Fran, I can't wait to hear it.
Well, in fact, you don't have to because here she is.
This is ABC Radio National.
Fran Lebowitz, welcome to the Radio National Hour.
Thank you.
It's an absolute pleasure to have you here, Fran. Fran, so many Australians right now are highly engaged with your politics over there, and at this moment it's impossible to escape the Epstein files. And for many decades, New York, your town, was the epicentre of all this nefarious activity we're learning about now. How do you feel about that? How do you reflect on that?
Well, it's impossible for everyone to escape it except Donald Trump, who's still trying to escape it all the time. I don't think you can blame Jeffrey Epstein on New York. That's not fair to New York. You know, I mean, you can blame the people involved with him, and there seem to be plenty of them. I mean, dozens, hundreds, apparently. But I don't think it's the fault of New York.
It does. It seems to draw back from this distance, draws back the curtain on the millionaires and the billionaires who are wheeling and dealing there in New York City, and reveals a horrible underbelly of the city where women and girls are being trafficked in plain sight, seemingly without consequence. You know, we're not talking about the sharks and jets on the streets here. We're talking about the rich and powerful behind closed doors. Is that how New Yorkers see their town, or do you think this would be any kind of shock to them?
Well, I mean, first of all, it's been in the news here literally for years. You know, it comes and goes in the news. And I don't know how many, almost 9 million people live in New York. You know, I don't know how many were aware of Jeffrey Epstein before all this. I mean, I was. I think, you know, this kind of, this is not, when I say it's not new, I mean, it is, this is the way that people, when I say people, I mean men, actually. This is the way men behaved when they have absolutely no constraints on them, okay? And that's what it seems like to me, because some of these names on these lists were really surprising to me. Not all of them, but some of them were. And so I think that, you know, they have, first of all, rich people are way too rich now, not just here, all over the world. The rich people didn't used to be this rich. They are too rich. The reason they're so rich here, anyway, is because they don't pay taxes. The richer you are, the fewer taxes you pay. So, you know, I could kind of solve this, you know, by any billionaire pay anywhere near the percentage of their income in taxes that I do, they wouldn't really have the money for this. So, it's terrible. It's awful. You know, I mean, I don't think anyone, certainly no one publicly, would say how great it is. It's terrible. But, you know, really, you know, they have this, they don't have Jeffrey Epstein in any country, and we don't have Jeffrey Epstein anymore here either, but this kind of thing, you know, goes on all around the world when there are any type of concentration of stupidly extreme wealth.
And what we see, I mean, at the heart of this is, as you say, men behaving in this way because they can, because they are rich and powerful and feel that they have special entitlements. And what they're doing actually is not just misogyny, it's worse than that. I mean, they are trafficking, they are degrading women and girls. And it's been striking to me, all this focus around the billionaires, the people whose names we know and, you know, have respected some of them for a long time, you know, and the question about who funded Jeffrey Epstein, was he a Russian spy, was he a Mossad spy? And the women and the girls at the heart of this overlooked or forgotten?
Yes, of course they are, because they're the victims and because the word that's not very much used in regard to this story is rape. Okay, so this is rape. You know, when it's against your will, then it's rape. And so this is kind of a rape den, you know, and you don't hear this word here, you know, all the time in regard, for instance, to abortion laws, you or anti-abortion laws, you hear, except in the case of rape or incest. And I always say, you know what, incest is rape. I just said this to a guy the other night. I said, look, let me explain something to you. I was a 14-year-old girl. Not recently, not by far. But a 14-year-old girl is a child. I don't care what you look like. You know, I mean, I didn't look like a woman when I was 14, but a lot of girls do. And men don't care. These men don't care.
No, and as you say, rape is what it is, and that's a powerful word. And what they've been doing is, you know, is gravely criminal acts. But do you think there'll be consequences? So far, there's no consequences in terms of the law. But what about judgment by the people, by Americans, in terms of, you know, the curtain has been pulled back on the behavior and the entitlement of these elites? Do you think that'll change anything?
Well, I mean, I don't, of course, personally know anyone who doesn't think this is horrible. You know,
a lot of
focus has been on Donald Trump because he had a very long relationship with Jeffrey Epstein. And, you know, Donald Trump, you know, wants to avoid any connection to this. And he's tremendously connected to it. You know, unfortunately, to me, it is not that Donald Trump was there, which is not surprising to me, but that he's the president. That's the horrible thing. Okay, so, and you know, I mean, some of the, there's the only person that I'm aware of that's gone to jail for this is Ghislaine Maxwell, as she should have gone to jail. I'm not saying she shouldn't, but, you know, if you're asking me if these rich guys are going to go to jail, I don't think so.
Well, someone who is trying to change things in America and in your town of New York is the newly elected mayor, Zoran Mamdani. You know, in the past, you've said you didn't agree with everything he stood for. He ran on, part of his platform was the city for many, not the few. That seems perfectly timed right now. How do you feel about the new mayor?
You know, I voted for him. You know, yes, of course, he's to the left of me. You know, part of the fact that he's listened to me, I am much older than he is, okay? So, you know, although I can't remember, I mean, I was maybe as left as he purports to be when I was maybe 21. Okay, so he's 34. Everyone keeps talking about how young he is. And I keep saying to people, he's younger than us, because who isn't? But, you know, he's not too young to be the mayor, not by far. And many of the things that he believes in or says he believes in, and I believe him, actually, he's quite earnest, you know. I maybe believed in him when I was 20, you know, because I think he's naive in a lot of ways. But so far, he's been good. You know, the truth is that I lived in New York for over 50 years. There's only been two mayors I liked. I don't have to like the mayor. The one thing about New York is that if we have a bad mayor, which we mostly have had, or a mayor you don't like, you just ignore him. New Yorkers don't really have time for this because it's so expensive to live here. So I think that, you know, Mamdani is very popular. I was really surprised at how kind of global this race became, because I was in Europe in the fall, and one night in Zurich, I got all these questions about the mayoral race, and I was really surprised. I said, really? You live in Zurich. Why do you care who the mayor of New York is? I don't know who the mayor of Zurich is, and don't tell me. So it became kind of a global thing. I think that he's pretty well-liked. I mean, he's only been in office like 5 minutes. You know, I don't think, you know, he's done anything that really bothers people. Well, we've had tremendous cold snap. I mean, even, you know, really, really freezing beyond belief. And something like, I could be wrong, something like 18 people died because they were outside in the cold. And he got blamed for this, which to me is absurd. The homeless problem is not his fault. It preceded him, and I will bet you anything, it will still be here when he's gone. So there are people who wouldn't go inside, but, you know, I don't think you can blame the mayor for every single thing that happens in New York.
Nevertheless, do you think he'll succeed? He's likely to succeed against the powerful elites we've just been talking about?
I think, you know, a lot of them like him in a way. You know, first of all, one thing about New York, and I would say this is true of other cities too, especially, say, L.A., is that once you succeed at something, the people who didn't like you now because they're a success. So, you know, being a success is, you know, something that other successful people like. And, you know, he's not going to be able to do a lot of these things that he wants to do. And certainly he must have known it.
And so, you know, whoever is the mayor, people have to deal with. I don't mean the average person, but, you know, for instance, the big real exchanges were very opposed to him. Believe me, they'll be getting along with him because they have to, and because he has to get along with them. So, you know, when you take a very, extreme position, you can never keep that when you're actually in power, not here, unless you're Donald Trump, you know, and you just don't pay attention to anyone else.
Fran Lebowitz is my guest. She's the ultimate New Yorker. She's joining me here on the Radio National Hour. New York is your town, Fran. The tourists in New York, I've heard you say many times, are the bane of your existence. You've said in the past, immigrants make the culture, tourists ruin it. The nation that elected Donald Trump on an anti-immigration platform doesn't seem to agree with you. Are you out of step?
Good. Who wants to agree with them? Not me.
Well, I mean, we watch on in Australia again as, you know, there's ICE officers roaming the streets, armed to the teeth, rounding up illegal and some legal immigrants. Have you felt the impact of that, of Trump's immigration policies in New York there, where you are? Can you see it?
Well, I've never seen it. You know, I mean, I'm in the street a lot because what they've done in New York mostly is not roam around the way that you see them doing in Minneapolis, for instance. You know, they go to the court houses because apparently if you have a certain kind of immigration status, you're not a citizen, you're not a permanent, you don't have permanent permission, you have to keep checking in. So when these people, very law-abiding, go to the court to check in, that's when they grab them. Okay, so they've been stopped a lot in New York. She's not going to send those zillions of people into New York City because she's afraid of New York. New York is where Donald Trump failed. He's not, you know, Minneapolis. I mean, the idea of Minneapolis as some sort of dangerous place, you may never have been there, but I've been there quite often. Minneapolis, and the reason I've been there very often is Minneapolis, which is not one of the biggest cities in the country, is one of the biggest book markets. So if you ask me, what do people do in Minneapolis? I would tell you they read, you know, stormtroopers. That's what they are. I mean, into Minneapolis, she did not send that kind of presence into New York City. Not even close. And he would not succeed doing that here. I mean, of all the terrible things Donald Trump has done, and every single thing he does is terrible, to me, this is by far the worst. By far the worst. It is really horrible. You know, I mean, you see it. What does this remind you of? And not in some, you know, kind of amorphous way. This is what the Nazis did. That's what this is exactly. I mean, this isn't kind of like, or maybe, this is exactly, and it's enraging, it's stomach-turning, apparently not that popular, even with people who voted for him, but not that unpopular either, you know. And it's grotesque, it's morally grotesque.
Are you worried for America? Do you think it can redirect itself? Would this could be the thing that changes people's mind?
The damage that Donald Trump has done to this country would take, if it gets corrected, you know, which would have to be through elections, which they're already trying to rig, would take years and years to repair. You know, one thing, it's very easy to destroy something. I always say to people, if you ever renovated an apartment in New York City, you know what happens. The contractors come in, they knock everything down, and then they leave. And it takes forever for them to come back and build it. So, you know, he loves to knock things down. He's very destructive. He knocked down the White House. I mean, I found this jaw-dropping.
You're listening to Radio National Hour. I'm speaking with author and social commentator Fran Lebowitz, who is coming to Australia a little later this year. Fran, you were in New York through the 80s and the early 90s, and you've spoken about the hole that AIDS left in the arts community there and in America. Do you see any elements of that sort of happening again now with the slashing of arts fund under the Trump administration, university funding, the squeeze on the cultural institutions to display what the government says they should display? I mean, he's even renamed the Kennedy Center in his honor.
Yeah, but then he closed it, you know. I mean, now it's closed. He closed it because once he renamed it, no one would perform there. So, I mean, no, I don't think it's like this. I don't think it's like the 70s or the 80s because, first of all, I think what's really hard for people who are not Americans to understand is how little government funding there ever was or ever is for the arts.
Mm.
I mean, the first time I went to Australia, actually, I was in Melbourne. I had like a few hours off. Someone in my hotel said, oh, there's a museum near here. So I went to the museum and I couldn't see where to pay. And so I said to a guard,
can you tell me where to pay? And he said, it's free. And I said, what do you mean? Okay. And he said, it's free. And I thought, who are you trying to kid? What do you mean? Is it a holiday? No, it's free. That's not true here. Okay. I mean, there's very little arts funding here, and there never has been much. And of course, the Republicans hate any if there's a dollar and they're upset about it. But the federal funding for arts is very, very small. And so, of course, they hate this stuff. They hate everything that makes them feel bad about themselves. And it never occurs to them that they feel bad about, they should feel bad about themselves.
Mm. Well, you're famously offline. You're speaking to me now on a landline. You don't do laptop, mobile phone, the internet. But let me tell you that earlier this year, in case you haven't heard, and I think you probably have, but there was a trend online of people reminiscing about 2016 because it was 10 years ago. There's also a trend for, you know, early 2000s fashion. Now, you know, fashion does have a habit of coming around again. But do you think there's a growing desire for or need for cultural nostalgia? And what do you think that's about?
I got to tell you something, yes, but that's been going on for a really a long time. I think it's terrible, okay? Because, you know, nostalgia is a cultural poison, you know, I think. I'm not talking about clothes, because truthfully, that it always happens. And the reason for that is that no matter how interested you are in clothes, really, it's a kind of limited field, okay? So, you know, yes, I mean, by the time I was, say, 30, I'd already seen platform shoes come back twice. And in my opinion, they were a bad idea to begin with. So, you know, those kind of things, it doesn't really matter. There isn't, but there's a nostalgia. What is somewhat surprising is there's a nostalgia for periods people did not live through. You know, to me, you know, like kind of when I would say, you know, nostalgia that is, I don't know what the word is, you know, natural, is people to have nostalgia for their own lives, for their own youth, say, okay? But listen, I get stopped in the street all the time by kids, by which I mean people in their 20s, telling me they wish they lived in New York in the 70s, okay? So, you know, they weren't alive for decades after the 70s. Do I think that's good for the culture? Not at all.
But doesn't that make sense that they wish they were alive in the 70s when they look at, you know, and read someone like you? You're a style icon. You're an archetypal New Yorker of the 70s. It was a time of social upheaval, cultural experimentation, particularly in New York. I mean, you're nostalgic for that time, aren't you?
I understand. But, you know, it's not a good thing for the present culture or the future culture. You know, it's just not a good thing. They always say it looks like it was so much more fun in the 70s. This happened to me so frequently that I started to think, was it more fun in the 70s? You know, but the truth is, I was in my 20s in the 70s. If you're asking me, is it more fun to be in the 20s, in your 20s in the 70s, than in your 70s in the 20s? Yes.
Yes, I agree with you.
Definitely more fun.
Everything's more fun in your 20s.
It's more fun in your 20s. And so, you know, what I would tell them is, you know what? You're in your 20s now. Have fun, because life does not get more and more fun the older you get. That I can assure you. So, you know, there is one thing the internet allowed, which I think is not a good thing, is all this looking back all the time. So they see all this stuff, but it has there's no context for it. You know, so everything is very flattening the internet, as far as I could tell. So everything has kind of the same effect and lack of affect, you know. So looking at a picture of something is not the thing, you know, at all. And so a different era the way any era will be different from preceding one. But not every person lived through the kind of huge change in the world that the internet caused. So, you know, of course, they don't know that because they never lived without it. But I do know it. And if there had not been the internet, it would not be this in the same way. But there is. So there's nothing to do about it.
You're listening to the Radio National Hour. My guest is author and professional opinion maker, archetypal New Yorker Fran Lebowitz. Fran, you're 75. Are you getting wiser as you get older?
No, I'm past the getting wiser part. Okay? I did get wiser, but then it levels off. All right? So,
then what happens?
Then, if you're lucky, you stay the same. But as you know, many people decline. So far, that hasn't happened to me, but I'm aware that it could. So that, you know, I mean, you know, what people mean by getting wiser in that way, I believe, is just you have more and more experience, you know, and so you know more and more things. And this, you know, this is interesting. I mean, I find it quite interesting being this age. Not that I would choose it, or someone said, or you could be 25, but no one says this. So, you know, it is quite interesting, but it's also because of the era I'm living in now. It's very depressing.
Fran, you're a, well, I just described you before as a professional opinion maker. Opinions is what you do.
But I'm not in charge of anything. I think it's all right for me to be this way. But if you happen to be, you know, the head of, you know, if you happen to be the Secretary of State, you ought to know stuff. You know, I mean, the people that are in this administration know nothing, nothing, nothing about anything. They're totally unqualified for these positions, which are big, giant jobs that are very difficult and require a lot of expertise. You know, so especially on the right, there is a disdain. You know, they're always talking about the elites, the elite, the first of all, they don't mean rich people. They love rich people. They mean smart people, or they mean competent people, or they mean anyone who has any skill or ability at anything whatsoever. Like, I always think, what are these people's lives like? Do they call each other and say, I have a horrible leak in my apartment. Do you know someone who's not a plumber? Because they don't know anything. I said to someone, I think it was today, maybe yesterday, asked me if I knew somebody. I said, you know what? They were telling me someone has this job. I said, really? In what way is she qualified for that job? This is like making me the head of the United States Olympic ski team. I don't know how to ski. I've never skied. I don't want to ski. And so I shouldn't be the head of the ski team. But Donald Trump was in charge and he liked me, I would be.
Well, you haven't been without ambition, though, Fran. You did want to be the mayor of New York at one point, I understand.
I would be happy to be the mayor of New York anytime. Okay, but I'm never going to be the mayor of New York. And I always knew that because I could never get elected. Sometimes I'll be at like a dinner party, like 12 people. And someone will say, well, you should be the mayor. And I always say something which I know is true. I couldn't win this room. And I know that.
But you don't try to. I mean, you pride yourself on being judgmental, on being revengeful, vengeful. I mean, you don't really try to win the hearts and minds, do you?
No, I don't. Okay, so I'd rather not be the mayor and not have to make up that I agree with you.
Well, you've won a lot of hearts and minds in Australia. When you've come here in the past, your shows have been packed out. You're due to do another round of shows here, an evening with Fran Lebowitz. One of your favourite things is getting direct questions from audience members. I would have thought that would irritate you no end, having people pry into your life. What do you like so much about it?
That's my favourite thing in the world, practically, is the questions from the audience. First of all, I think I like to answer questions. I think this stems from the fact that when I was a child, which was in the 1950s, no one ever asked a child a question. You know, to be a child in the 1950s was just to be, you know, ordered around from morning till night. So I love being asked questions. The questions from the audience, I do that because if you take questions from the audience, then you know what the audience wants to know about, or, you know, what they want to hear or talk about. I never know the questions in advance. Some people who do this take the questions before, you know, like on cards or on a whatever you call an iPad, whatever it is. But I don't see the questions until the second you see me on that stage. When the questions are asked, that's when I see the question. And I find it amusing. You know, I realize people don't come to see me so that I could have a good time. But I do have a good time.
Well, and why do you think people do come to see you? What are you trying to do with these talks? Are you trying to make us think, shed light on things? Are you trying to make people laugh? What's the mission?
I don't really have a mission. I mean, I do always tell other people who have to be on the stage for whatever reason. I always say, once you're on a stage, I don't care what you think you're there for. If you're a doctor and you're there to give some sort of medical information, if you're standing on a stage, you have to entertain people. I mean, to some extent, at least. And so, you know, I suppose I want people to be entertained, you know. And I know that they're not there so I can be entertained. But I am very entertained by this, I have to tell you.
Fran, it's been an absolute pleasure and a lot of fun. Thank you very much for joining me.
Thank you.
That was Fran Lebowitz. And if you've got a burning question for Fran, the other Fran, maybe you can ask her at one of her shows, An Evening with Fran Lebowitz, which will be touring around the country in May. And don't forget, you can tune in live 6 p.m. weeknights or catch up anytime on ABC Listen. And while you're there on the Listen app, give us a review. Tell my bosses how much you love this show. Hell, tell everybody how much you love this show. I hope you can join me tomorrow. Until then, have a great evening.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.